My 15-month-old hurt me this morning, and so I need to get this mouse as close to me as possible. I injured my back. Thank you, everyone, for coming today. The topic of my discussion today is social capital and its relationship to physical and mental health status. I wanted to look at the endogeneity dilemma between social capital and health status. I suspect almost everyone in here knows what social capital is, but by way of brief background, social capital and health has become an increasingly popular topic in the health arena in recent years, as many of you probably know. Most of the research in public health that looks at social capital uses definitions put forth by Robert Putnam in the early 90s for social capital, which suggests that social capital is refers to the social organizations and social structures that facilitate coordination and cooperation between parties within a community, however defined, in order to achieve certain ends that might not otherwise be achievable. It's a fairly vague definition, but it's a fairly popular definition. And it's led to a variety of different indicators for social capital in research studies. Some of these have included measures of trust, goodwill, cooperation, mutual obligations, mutual reciprocity. Those are common ones that have been used, and sense of community. Now, the major findings from my study are fourfold. First, I found that social capital and self-rated health are indeed endogenous. That is, there's a bidirectional relationship between social capital and self-rated health. Second, I found that this relationship, this association, is positive, as one might expect, but positive at the individual level, and that the effect of social capital on mental health is nearly 50% larger than the effect of social capital on physical health. Third, I found that this effect is independent of social support, which I measured as a separate orthogonal construct in my study. And fourth, I found that individuals who feel relatively deprived, people who feel that they're worse off relative to their peers, their neighbors, or their friends, they have a harder time translating social capital into health benefits. Now, the observed relationships that most people have reported in the literature have been looking at the relationship between community social capital, looking at social capital as a community-level variable, which is uniformly distributed throughout either counties or states or cities, depending upon what region you're using to define your measure of social capital. And as you all know, social ties have long been known to be related to health, but some researchers in a variety of different commentaries have questioned whether or not social capital is just old wine in new bottles. And I wanted to, in this study, see whether or not social support and social capital actually behaved independently, and whether or not social capital would have an independent effect on health, controlling for social support. Now, problems with the social capital research, of which you may well be aware, are first, the most obvious, that there's a definitional ambiguity because various people are using slightly different definitions for social capital. This creates some difficulties when you're trying to compare one research study to another and the significance of their results. Second is an issue of unit of analysis. You know, is social capital something that is only measurable and, frankly, defined at the community level, which is the more common way to see it done, or can you measure it at an individual level? And will the same sorts of relationships between social capital and health exist at an individual level as we've seen them to exist at a community level? And then finally, the elephant in the room for most social capital studies has been, you know, is there a bidirectional relationship between social capital and health? And if so, what, if anything, does that portend for, the results that have been reported thus far? Now, when you start to look at different definitions of social capital, you see people talking about social capital as social cohesion, people talking about, you know, anything which vaguely facilitates people's ability to achieve ends they might not otherwise be able to achieve, which seemingly could, you know, is so vague that it may well be unhelpful. And then other people more recently, like Flapp, have started to talk about resources that are accessible through one's personal social network. One of the first people who started talking about social capital in the 1980s was Pierre Bourdieu, who actually did define social capital at an individual level, but that seemed to have gotten lost in the 90s. And in my study, I was hoping to try to go harken back to the original conceptions of social capital and actually measure and define social capital at an individual level, not a collective level. So for my study, the definition that I use, I operationalize social capital as the resources which are embedded in social relations and social structure, which can be accessed by a single individual who wishes to increase the likelihood of realizing a given objective. Similar to previous definitions, but definitely rooted at the individual level. As for the endogeneity problem, many studies have just not looked at whether or not there actually is a bidirectional relationship between social capital and health, and they've simply looked at the former. The problem is that if, in fact, there is a bidirectional relationship between the two, and health does, in fact, better health enables your ability to either access or breed or build social capital, then you get a problem with the error term for your health equation and the error term for your social capital equation being correlated to a regressor in that equation. And when you just use OLS, as you probably know, this will lead to biased estimates. I wanted to try to address that as my first research question. The second thing I wanted to do, as I mentioned earlier, was look at whether or not social support actually had an independent effect on health, or whether or not it was simply a mediator, mediating the effect of social capital on health. And the third question that I wanted to look at was how a person's perception of their social status, economic status, educational achievement, this was essentially defined by the individual, how that might or might not affect social capital, and more importantly, how that might or might not affect their ability to translate social capital into health or better health. So I used a measure of relative well-being that literally said, how well off are you relative to your peers in your neighborhood, others in your neighborhood, to measure relative well-being, and looked at how relative well-being is associated with social capital, and then I looked at whether or not there was an interaction between social capital and relative well-being on self-rated health. I also threw in, as you would have expected, a number of exogenous X's, including the typical age, income, race, gender, and the community that you live in. The data for my study was the National Health Service Corps Community Assessment Survey. The NHSC in 1997-98 included a unique social capital instrument that hadn't previously been used on a large population that I'll discuss a little later. And the communities that I looked at eight communities in five different states listed on the slide, had a sample of about 6,000. Now, the instrument that was included in the NHSC is an instrument that was designed by Jim Burdine and Dana Safran at Harvard. It included a number of different measures, all of which were asked of single individuals, and they all dealt with the domains that are listed on this slide, including mutual trust between neighbors and friends, whether or not there are particular groups in your neighborhood that carried more political or social influence than others, whether or not there was a strong sense of community, what your perception of public safety was, and how politically active you were. Did you vote in the last election? Have you been to a town hall meeting recently? Some of the sorts of measures that Robert Putnam has used for many years. To measure health, I used the SF-12, which is a highly reliable measure that probably everyone in the room is familiar with. It breaks down into two subscales, one for mental health, one for physical health. The domains for the scales are listed on the slide above, and the SF-12 is normed to 50. In my study, I had a slightly less physically healthy and a slightly more mentally healthy population than one would have expected from a random sample from the United States. The methods I used to address the problem of endogeneity were two-stage least squares with instrumental variables. The instruments that I used are listed on this slide. For social capital, I used the number of years that you'd lived in your community, an index of cultural opportunities. This was an index that measured the number of recreational opportunities, art galleries, museums, things like that in your neighborhood. A crime index, that's the FBI crime index that's compiled by zip code every year. And the number of houses of worship in your zip code, simply on the theory that synagogues and churches have been argued to be breeding grounds for social capital, ways and places in which you are able to strengthen social ties or build connections between people in your neighborhood. Excuse me. For physical health, I used whether or not you had a smoking history and whether or not your current preventive screenings that you had within the last 2 years complied with CDC recommendations for your age. And for mental health, I used whether or not you had a history of depression and an air quality index. The theory there being twofold, but there's research out there that suggests that areas that are smoggier and have worse air quality also have a lower median mental health score for the members of those populations. And someone in a session earlier this week told me that there's also suggestions that some smog areas that have high densities of smog actually are reporting higher levels of, I didn't know this at the time, higher levels of bipolar disorder. This is coincidence. I had never heard this before. Maybe someone during the Q&A can tell me more if they know anything about this. I didn't at the time. For relative well-being, I used a measure of relative income, which is simply the difference between an individual's annual income and the median income for their zip code. And for mental health, for social support, I used the number of individuals in your home and whether or not you're married. What I found is that the effect of social capital on health, once you control for the endogeneity, is 3 to 4 times greater when you use two-stage least squares than when you use OLS. I had two subscales that I tested separately for social capital. The markers of social capital instrument separated into two independent indices or subscales. One measured civic participation, the other social integration. I found that civic participation was positively related to physical health, but not to mental health or to general health. General health being defined according to simply the one item measure that is commonly used in social capital studies, how good's your health, your overall health, excellent, very good, good, fair, poor. But I found that social integration was positively related to all measures of social self-rated health. I also found that the partial effect of social capital on health is positive and statistically significant even after controlling for social support. Finally, I also discovered that social support, at least in my study, was only related to mental and general health, not physical health. Something of a surprise. To summarize, my findings show that there is a bidirectional relationship between health, self-rated health, and social capital that hasn't been addressed in much of the literature, that the effect of social integration appears to be much larger than that of civic participation, and that the effect on mental health is about 50% larger than that on physical health. again, to reiterate, I found that social capital and social support appeared to be orthogonal the way I measured them, and that the effect of social capital on health remained statistically significant and positive even after controlling for social support, which again was defined by the number of individuals that would come to your aid in the event of a health or financial crisis. Relative well-being seems to mitigate the effects of social capital on health, and contrary to my own expectations, social integration increases as someone's relative well-being diminishes. That is, the worse off you feel relative to your peers, the more socially integrated you feel in your neighborhood. I can think of a number of reasons why this might be the case, but in the interest of time, I'll keep moving, and we can maybe talk about that during the Q&A. I found that civic participation was negatively affected, if you felt worse than those who lived in immediate proximity to you. Now, the study limitations include the fact that this was a sample of convenience, that I had a really very white middle class sample, with the exception of North Philadelphia, which was very diverse. In general, the populations I was looking at were not heterogeneous at all. I used clustered hierarchical data, and I could not use hierarchical linear modeling to adjust for the potential autocorrelation between people in the same community simply because of the sample size that I was working with. And I used self-rated health. Future studies would be great if future studies actually took clinical measures, say of hypertension, and then started to look at how social capital might be related to these things. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go into various policy options, but I'd be happy to talk about these during the Q&A. The things on the screen are just some policy options that legislators and lawmakers might want to consider if they were interested in bolstering social capital. Thank you very much.